Hey everybody, before we start this episode, we wanted to let you know that we're running a special giveaway via our social medias. This time we're giving away 4 copies of The King of Staten Island. If you haven't heard about this film before, it comes from celebrated comedy director Judd Apatow and SNL's Pete Davidson. It's critically acclaimed, it's heartfelt, and it's comedic, and it'll all be available on digital and Blu-ray August 25th. Now, these special DVDs features over 2 hours of hilarious, never-before-seen content, including alternate endings, deleted scenes, and, of course, a gag reel. And if you didn't know, this is actually a film inspired by Pete Davidson's own true story. So head on over to our social media at ButWhyThoughPC on Twitter and Facebook, and you can enter for your chance to win a copy now. Welcome back to But Why Though, the podcast, and today we're going to be talking about one of the most formative forces in science fiction, Isaac Asimov. As always, I'm Kate, and I'm here with Adrian.
Hey, how's it going?
And Matt.
Hello.
And today we have a special guest who is also the reason that our podcast sounds good, Jason.
Hey.
Hey.
It's been a very long time since you've been on the show, so... One, thank you for that. Two, I think this is the first time you've been on the show since you've been our producer.
That is true. It's been like at least 3 decades or so.
Yeah. And that's just since March.
Exactly.
I think BoJack Horseman, which I believe is in the 70s.
Oh, that's what it was.
Is
yes.
BoJack.
It was back when I was interning in a place in Baltimore and commuting back and forth every week, and I was at an Airbnb doing that last recording, so it's been a while. Back when Airbnbs were safe.
Oh, gosh. So for everybody listening who don't know you like we know you, why don't you give them a quick intro to you and why you're on this episode?
Sure. I am the senior editor at But Why Though, where I edit people's written work on our website, butwhythepodcast.com, and I also edit the podcast every week. And I'm on the show today because I like Isaac Asimov books. I've been reading them for a couple of years, and there's a new series that was announced on Apple TV Plus based on one of his series, and then I said, we should do him. Now here we are.
That is correct. As I looked in the spreadsheet, and I was like, oh, Jason put a topic on here.
And it's one of the more serious topics I've recommended in recent months.
This is not true. Luigi.
We'll get there.
Yeah. So to start everything off, I'm going to be leading this episode mainly based on my really, really strong obsession with the 3 laws of robotics, which is some weird thing in my science fiction brain. But to start off with our question, as we always do before we move into history, have y'all read Isaac Asimov's work? And if you have, what's your favorite thing?
I'll go first. So I'm going to probably go with no, but obviously I know him for like different reasons. Obviously the 3 laws of robotics, as you mentioned, and then obviously the movies that were kind of adapted into that stuff. And then, obviously, the weird thing is I know him from the American Humanist Association. That would probably be my first introduction to kind of stuff. Like, I guess I knew the work, but, like, knowing, like, you know, more about him in that sense. Obviously, as everybody probably knows, I'm an atheist on this thing, so obviously I know the organization and everything else along with other stuff. But that's probably, like, I don't think I've ever read any of his stuff, per se. Maybe some short, like, tidbits from it, but overall, like, not Jason-filled of reading books.
This is like the perfect moment for my fun fact, which was that he was one of the presidents of the American Humanist Association, and he was in it with Gene Roddenberry, because two of the biggest science fiction forces were atheists, which is really cool, in my opinion.
Yeah, anyway. But that's how I knew him before even his like way of science fiction.
Adrian?
Does really, really liking the Will Smith iRobot movie count?
Yes, it counts.
Reading his work.
No gatekeeping Asimov here.
Just watching Bicentennial Man like on AMC.
Yes.
I hate that movie so much.
So do I, but... Yeah.
No, I haven't read any of his work, but just being kind of like, you know, pop culturally literate. I know that he's basically like the father of, you know, science fiction robotics wise. And I think we might have talked about him a little bit on our when we talked, like whenever we've talked Star Trek. I'm pretty sure we brought him up a couple times.
I think we did, because he worked as a consultant on it.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure, so I know him from like that more than I do, I guess, all of these books that you're going to talk about here in a little bit. But haven't read anything, but I do like science fiction and I do like robots. So, and Jason said that they're on audiobook, and I do love audiobooks. So,
I'll go next so that Jason can take us home with his more knowledge than me. I have read a lot of the Isaac Asimov short stories. I've never read his entire, like any of his series in entirety. But I do think my favorite book, which I have two copies. I have one with the original cover art, and then I have one with the Will Smith cover art, is no surprise to anybody, but a very basic answer, iRobot. Because I just really enjoy that book. I talk about a lot, whenever we bring in anything that's book related, I talk about how I've read stuff with my dad, and my dad really likes Isaac Asimov like a whole bunch. To this day, my dad won't say that he's an atheist, but given my dad's like library that he kept and the people that he loved the most, I'm very interested to know. It fits and it tracks, but I'll leave that neither here nor there. But yeah, I really like that. And more specifically, I just am really fascinated with the concepts of the three laws of robotics, just because, a fun fact about me is when I was doing my master's work my first year, I did a seminar in science and religion specifically, and that actually helped bring me to, I got to go to SETI to hear a talk and conference about extraterrestrial life, and all of that also coincides with robotics a lot of the time. So that kind of really, that was really formative for my academic career. So, yeah, Isaac Asimov is dope when it comes to his writing. Jason.
Yeah, I have read a good few Asimov books and short stories. I think it wasn't all that long ago I got into him. I mean, it was maybe the summer of, like, 2015 was the first time I'd ever even heard of him. And it was because I was reading an article about Ralph McQuarrie, drawings of robots, and how in the 80s he made new covers for the Asimov's robot books, and I was reading this article and went, who's this guy? And then looked him up and was like, oh, he's got a ton of books that are like all in one fiction. Let's start with the first one. And so I've read the first three of the four robots books, which is where the three laws of robotics comes from, and like where iRobot and a ton of his short stories fit in. I've read two of the three Empire books, and then I started listening to Foundation yesterday, which is his most famous book, but I didn't start with it because it's like book 7 in the chronology, and I wanted to read them in the like chronological order. Because He's one of those guys that, you know, wrote short stories in the 40s and 50s and then put them into books later because that's how publishing worked then. Yep. And then in, like, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, he was still writing and said, you know, actually, all these stories really, they're all one story, even though they weren't originally. and decided this is the new order, this is the chronology, and this is how you should read them. And so that's the order I've been reading them in over the last bunch of years. And the robot books are my favorite, and we'll get into why they are, I'm sure, plenty as we go along. But I've read some of the short stories here and there, but I mean, the dude's got literally just dozens of books and hundreds of short stories in on so many subjects. It would be impossible for somebody to read all of them within a span of time that's more than reasonable.
And I will say, too, kind of as we move into the history, when we think about science fiction as a genre, there are, like, really two people, in my opinion, that kind of shape it. And the first is Mary Shelley with Frankenstein. She kind of she begins science fiction when it comes to, like, medical and technology advancement. So the more human side of it. And then on the other side, you have Isaac Asimov, who advances science fiction as a genre through robots, which is another one of the things that, like, we really know, which is funny because he got critiqued a lot for it, which we'll get into. So as we move into his history, Isaac Asimov was an American writer and professor of biochemistry at Boston University. So not only did this man have a prolific writing career, he actually had a full career in academia. I believe he got into one of the Columbia colleges when he was 15 years old after being denied a whole bunch of times. And then he started his college education at 15, which eventually led him to pursue medicine, which is what he wanted to do. He then got denied from all of the med schools that he applied to, and then he applied to biochemistry and got denied there. And then after a process, he finally got into a biochemistry PhD program, and he became probably one of the most well-known popular science writers as well at the time, in conjunction to being one of the best-known science fiction authors as well.
I like the funny thing about that is, like, he was getting rejected for this stuff, like, at 16, 17, 18. Like, now people don't even apply until, like, 20.
Yeah, he was also, like, an on-again, off-again member of Mensa, too. There was just, like, weird stuff going on there, but the man was intelligent. That much was sure. So he is known for his works in science fiction and popular science. Like I said, the difference between popular science and science textbooks is that popular science is made for mass consumption. And like most things in academia, not everybody likes that you publish those things. But he has a very, very long bibliography of different types of astrophysics, physics, chemistry, all those types of things that he used to write. His original name was Isaac Judah Asimov, so I-S-A-A-K. And then his last name was spelled O-Z-I-M-O-V. But because him and his family were immigrants from Peshevichi, Russia, they ended up anglicizing their name when they came to the United States, like many people did and still do, which is how we end up with his current spelling, which is I-S-A-A-C-A-S-I-M-O-V. And a lot of that just had to do with how the Cyrillic alphabet transferred over to American English. Asimov wrote hard science fiction, so this is a lot of the differentiations between light science fiction and hard science fiction, or science fiction light, is just how much you're pushing the boundaries of the concepts that you're utilizing. So if you think about something that's light science fiction, it'll probably be something that is closer to our near future with small deviations in technology. Technically, you could look at that last season of Parks and Rec as light science fiction because of the differences that they use with technology, and then something that would be hard science fiction would be something like Star Trek or Asimov's work. Just like the farther away you get from the present and the more advanced you get with technology kind of is where that line gets drawn, which again is fairly subjective too. Along with Robert A. Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke, Asimov was considered one of the big three science fiction writers during his lifetime. Asimov's most famous work is the Foundation series, and the first three books won the one-time Hugo Award for Best All-Time Series in 1966. His other major series, the Galactic Empire series and the Robot series, The Galactic Empire novels are set in an earlier history of the same fictional universe of the Foundation series, back to what Jason said, where he was just like, yo, this is all one giant story. And then...
Yeah, the Empire books weren't even, like, related to each other. They're still not related to each other. None of them are connected to any of the other stories. They just, like, take place in the same general time period-ish, sort of.
It reminds me of Tolkien and his appendices, if I'm being honest. So the first three... I keep losing my spot. Okay. And then later, The Foundation of Earth in 1986, he linked To a Distant Future to the Robot series, created by creating a unified future history for the series, much like those pioneered by Robert Heinlein and previously Cardwinder Smith and Paul Anderson. He also wrote hundreds of short stories, including social science fiction novelette Nightfall, which is good. I like that one. Which came out in 1964 and was voted best short science fiction story of all time by the Science Fiction Writers of America. Asimov also wrote the Lucky Star series, which is a YA science fiction novel series using the pen name Paul French. And then, in addition to that, Asimov also wrote mysteries and fantasies, as well as much of nonfiction. Most of his popular science books explain concepts in a historical way, going as far back as possible to a time when science in question was at the simplest stage. Examples include Guide to Science, the 3-volume of Understanding Physics, The Asimov's Chronology of Science and Discovery, and he also wrote numerous other scientific and non-scientific topics such as chemistry, astronomy, mathematics, history, biblical exegesis, and literary criticism.
So I will say, I probably have heard, obviously watched enough science shows to hear probably more of those works referenced than I have the other actual science fiction stuff. Which is kind of weird because, like, I was excited about this, but then as you said, I was like, I don't know if I know as much, but I knew he did science fiction, but that's not how I came to know him.
Yeah, because it's one of those things is when you look at his writing career, he very much has periods where he goes hard nonfiction and then straight back into academia, popular nonfiction, fiction, straight back into academia. And when I was looking at his timeline, it was actually really interesting, and I understood it because in the biography pages that I was looking at didn't say this, but it reminds me a lot of, like, when people in academia do really, really hard to get their first 2 books published before tenure, and then they get a sabbatical, and then they do all the stuff they wanted to do, and then they have to come back after tenure, pop out like 5 or 6 books, and then they get to do the thing they like again. And I don't know if that was the case for Asimov, but knowing that he kept his full academic career during the entirety of his writing, I would feel comfortable saying that's probably what happened.
No, we all get antsy. We want to move. Get tired of work.
And as always, we're going to shift into your But Why Those, but we're going to do it after this message from Manscaped.
2020 has been the year of things happening that are completely out of your control, but there is one thing that you can control, and that's shaving your bush. Our sponsor at Manscaped are here to remind you to do so.
Yeah, and I'm going to talk about the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0. It's a premium electric trimmer that's designed to give you a confident boost through body image. Plus, their ceramic blade and skin-safe technology are designed to reduce nicks or tugs on your fellow down low. The Lawnmower 3.0 is also waterproof and comes with a nice LED light, so you can manscape in the shower, in the dark, or in a dark shower, whatever floats your boat.
And they have more than just ways to shave your balls. Now, with the Shears 2.0 Nail Kit, this also allows you to now pluck your eyebrows and trim your nails in style. That's not all. You can also clean your nose and your ears with the Weed Whacker, featuring the same skin-safe technology that you use on your balls.
So, this is where I tell you, you treat your face well, you might as well treat your balls well, too. You can pick up other products like the Crop Reviver, a testy toner that's like having cologne that is designed for your balls, and the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. Plus, listeners of this show get 20% off and free shipping with code BUTWHYTHOUGH at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com when you use the code BUTWHYTHOUGH, B-U-T-W-H-Y-T-H-O. So take care of your balls! Now, as we move into the but why those, the first one, and pretty much the one that is the overarching one for the entire reason that we're talking about him, is writing. So Asimov's career can be divided into several periods. His early career was dominated by science fiction, and it began with short stories in 1939 and then novels in 1950. This lasted until about 1958, all but ending after the publication of The Naked Sun. After that, he began publishing nonfiction as co-author of a college-level textbook called Biochemistry and Human Metabolism. Following the brief orbit of the first man-made satellite, Sputnik, by the USSR in 1957, his production of nonfiction, particularly popular science books, greatly increased, and a consequent drop in his science fiction output happened. Then in the 1980s, the second half of his science fiction career began with the publication of the Foundation's Edge. From then until his death, Asimov published several more sequels and prequels to his existing novels, tying them together in a way that he had not originally anticipated and making them a unified series. When you break down what Asimov has written series-wise, he's actually written more series than any other science fiction author, with 5 complete ones under his belt. Asimov also won 18 awards while he was alive, which included the Hugo Award for Best Novel for The Gods Themselves and the Hugo Award for Best Nonfiction Book, which is I, Asimov, A Memoir. I do want to ask Matt, since he's the designated scientist on this podcast, if you could explain a little bit about, like, what popular science writing is.
Just ask Bill Nye on that, I guess. That'd be... I mean, obviously anybody that's done academia, at least from looking at the science stuff and, like, even with the shows, of there's just a language barrier, and so... At least in my sense, when it comes to doing a large general audience, obviously I didn't do these hard stuff, but when I did do, like, I did obviously a lot of, like, plant vegetation type stuff when I did it, and so what our goal was from there was to be able to teach something that, you know, at the level of, you know, science, you know, with, like, there's, like, 150 different terms just to name the pubescent of a plant. And, you know, how they are. That's just variations of hairs. And so what our goal was there, which I'm assuming what you're referring to here, of trying to do it to a general audience, was trying to relay this information without saying, just overwhelming people with a, basically a different language barrier. And so I'm assuming doing this, and I mean, even you spoke in for, because of your stuff, of just like, there are books in academia that are written for like 10 people, and then there's stuff that's like, as they call it, you know, the pop science or pop fiction or popular culture or whatever stuff, where basically they throw popular at the in the beginning of it, and that's designed to try to get people interested in more of these things. I mean, to me, this has been one of my biggest critiques that me and I have talked about when it comes to doing these types of writings and basically education, of like, people try to use the $20 words all the time. And it actually turns off a lot of people, to where if we actually, not necessarily dumb down what we're teaching, but just kind of break this language barrier, because, I mean, everything's written, especially in science, and basically Latin and all this other stuff. And so, like, if you just break down these, like I said, essentially a language barrier, you can probably get more people interested in science and chemistry and everything, and just kind of explain it from a fundamental, like, easy, you know, to relatable way to everybody, instead of like, hey, you know, what are these, you know, potassium sodium channels and iodines and, you know, pubescent stuff. And like I said, I can sit here and throw out random terms all day long, and I mean, I sound smart all I want, and, you know, some bit of it is education and what they do, but for the common person and general audience, they're not gonna know what the hell I meant to say and probably just tune me out.
And, like, the reason I kind of wanted you to mention that is when I was putting together the notes, I was thinking about, like, how different academia was structured back then, because I've said it multiple times already, he had a full academic career while also writing science fiction, writing so much popular science, because, and it's weird to me, because now, when I was doing my PhD, if you got branded a popular scholar, like, that was actually, like, that was a slight against you. Like if somebody would say, "Oh yeah, you're writing a popular book, or you're doing popular theology or something like that," it was used to kind of like put you down a little bit because you weren't writing for that academic audience. And so now I think it's really weird looking back, because when we look at like the history of authors that we have in things like fantasy and science fiction, like even thinking about Tolkien and stuff, like academia was very much also a very good place for producing fiction and for producing things that weren't just going to be those 10 people audiences. And now, at least in my field, it was you got shunned for it. And it's one of the reasons like I left, because I was doing popular culture as a scholarly study. And you had to, like, they wanted me to make the choice. Do you do this purely scholarly, or you do this for a popular audience? And so I guess just looking at Asimov's work, it's amazing the type of impact that he was able to have on every single one of these levels, from pure fiction to popular audience to pure academic.
I would say, like, obviously I can't speak for everybody, you know, I guess obviously what field I was in and everything, and it's science and stuff, but I do know there's quite a few scientists, especially these days, that are pushing for trying to, you know, make stuff, you know, like this per se. Because, I mean, we talk about Star Wars is a big one. We talk about how, and you've mentioned it, even Star Trek, as we've done before, of like just doing these types of stories has, like, you know, integrating science has made it to where they are taking concepts and they are taking kind of like actual fundamental stuff, but they made it to where people enjoy it, to where all of a sudden now we have astrophysicists. Now we have, you know, actual, you know, not astrophysicists, but, you know, just a physicist in general, you know, biologist and roboticists, as they say.
I mean, like, half the people on the U.S. space station right now are literally giant Star Trek fans who decided that they wanted to be astronauts because of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's been weird seeing, like, as we've gotten more of, like, I've seen a pushback, because it seems like that has gone, at least in my field as well, of, like, people just like, you know, this is what we do, this is who we interact with, you know, don't talk to the plebs. But, you know, there is a pushback of using stuff. I mean, the funny thing is, we even want to branch out as far as much, even kind of a little, almost like tangent-wise, of, like, at least in my field, using social media in general is bad. But,
oh, yeah.
And so, like, it's funny, because we talk, like, you know, using social media, even Twitter, like, how dare you? What is wrong with you? But then you see, you know, kind of the pushback of, like, people should get on there. So, one, you can inform general masses, and you can inform just the general public and get people to talk to you and stuff, so they don't have to go spend, you know, $300 to go to a random conference so you can spit out a bunch of words that basically just said, I collected plants. And that's it.
I mean,
it.
I got scolded when I started this podcast by my advisors, because they said it was going to ruin my academic career.
Just don't ask what a biome is on this podcast.
Yeah, you're gonna get yelled at.
Well, no, I mean, it's weird because people think about it and laugh, but it's literally that is what ends up happening and why we end up with these, like, tiered or academia or just, like, elitist type stuff, because it's either you join this elitist stuff and use your $20 words, or we don't care what you have to say. Like, I got probably shunned all the time because they're like, why did you explain that without using, you know, the quote-unquote proper terminology all the time? And I'm like, because it still means the exact same thing. It's just now I can say that to anybody. I can say that to, like, my mom. I can say that to, like, a child. I can say that to thing, and they'll understand what I'm saying, at least in some concept, versus what you just said. 90% of the people in the country or even the world have no idea what you just meant.
So two things. One, this is why Bill Nye discovering TikTok is the best thing. Two, this actually goes really well into another fun fact, and a bigger point, but a fun fact, which I kind of already alluded to. So both Gene Roddenberry and Isaac Asimov knew each other. And part of it was the humanist, was being a part of the Humanist Association. But the other part is because when Star Trek originally ran in the 60s, Isaac Asimov did not like it because of inconsistencies with actual science. And so Gene Roddenberry wrote him this really, really long letter because he actually was such a giant fan of Asimov's work. And he finished that letter by saying, this may not be 100% correct, but what it will do is it will make new science fiction fans who will go read your work. and who will go do these, and who will go to do science outside of that. And from that letter, you end up having a really strong relationship developing between Asimov and Roddenberry as friends, but also in a creative capacity, where Roddenberry, who is already using science consultants on the original Star Trek, then brought in Asimov to do those as well. It got to the point to where Roddenberry wanted to adapt, I think it was specifically iRobot, but he wanted to adapt some of Asimov's works. Unfortunately, they both died before any of that happened. But it's one of those things where in Asimov's own career, and like when you think about science fiction, especially in the United States, it is Asimov, and then it is also Roddenberry when you look at like who has had an impact on us in two different mediums, right? Literature and then television. And so to know that they also had this kind of discussion is also really, really interesting and really intriguing. And it really points to the importance of wanting to reach new people consistently.
That's also just hilarious because Asimov just made stuff up all the time. Like, that's what science fiction is. like, what is he complaining about? He literally wrote his first book was about an atom that gets split and a guy slips in 10,000 years into the future by accident. Like,
well, because you have this weird thing, because like, there are some science fiction authors who like literally claim that like this is fake, but it's fake based on X, Y, and Z principles that are real principles.
Which is how that should always be, because when you break the principles, then it bugs me. Like, I have that problem.
We're
too.
Not
like,
going to talk about time travel.
We're going to go in there. But I'm just saying in general, like, as long as you have and meet the principles or set whatever guidelines you're doing, it's fine to make up stuff, but you still have to have principles and laws and fundamentals of what you're writing. Because once you break those,
no, of course,
then it just makes no damn sense. Time travel.
That's why Star Wars isn't science fiction.
Yep, it's a space opera, like, and it's a fantasy. Yes,
and it's like, I just imagine Asimov being like, Gene, your fake stuff's just too fake. My fake stuff's at least real.
I mean, at least there's a lot of stuff we've seen, and Kate makes fun of a lot of my the movies that we've talked about before. Why watch a bunch of disaster type movies that has terrible science in it? But
Geostorm.
Is one of,
we went to the theater to watch Geostorm. Just
Geostorm
saying.
Geostorm is one of the worst ones. All the big budget ones are terrible. The better ones are. Yeah. But no, Sharknado? It's just one of. No. But no, like if some of these ones where they're like, you know, theoretically, based on all of the principles and stuff, this could happen. But it probably is so minute it would never happen. But let's make a movie on this thing that one in quadrillion thing could happen. Because it's possible. But it's never going to happen.
So before we, I've broken down the main but why though, which is his writing into different sections. And the first of which is the critiques of his writing, because I figured I would sandwich good, bad, good for the easiest consumption of this podcast, because I feel like most of my episodes end with a sad note because I don't know how to do that usually. So we're going to dive
classic
into the...
Classic management.
And so we're going to jump into the critiques of his writing, and the first of which is his portrayal of women, because shocker, a man in the 1930s to 70s could not write women well. In a surprise to everyone.
That's why I went to robots. They were easier.
So Asimov ultimately was critiqued for a lack of strong female characters in his early work. In his autobiographical writings, such as Gold, Women in Science Fiction, he acknowledges this and responds by pointing to inexperience. His later novels were written with more female characters, but it was essentially the same prose style as his early science fiction stories, which brought this matter to a wider audience. For example, in 1985, Washington Post Book World section reports Robots and Empires as follows. In 1940, Asimov's humans were stripped down, masculine portraits of Americans from the 1940s, and they still are. His robots were tin cans with speed lines like an old Studebaker, and still are. The robot tails depended on increasingly unworkable distinction between movable and unmovable artificial intelligences, and still do. In the Asimov universe, because it was conceived a long time ago and because its author abhors confusion, there are no computers whose impact is worth noting, no social complexities, no genetic engineering, aliens, archaeologies, multiverses, clones, sin, or sex. His heroes, in this case, are Zeniel Alawal, whom we first met as a robot protagonist in The Caves of Steel and its sequels, feel no pressure of information and raw or cooked, and as the simplest of us do today, they suffer no deformation from the winds of the Asimov future because it's so deeply, strikingly orderly. So that, to me, as much as it's, and the reason I included that full quote, other than it being on, you know, what I came up, you know, came upon, was the fact that I think that, like, as much as this piece was a critique of how he writes women, it's also a larger critique of why I kind of didn't get into a lot of the series that Asimov has, because he's very straightforward. Matt, you would actually really like Asimov's writing, because he is very straightforward. He is logical. There's a start point, there's an end point, and there's, like, no, like, I don't know, like, his humans have, like, next to no ambiguity in how they feel things or think of things and that kind of stuff. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Jason, but it is just very there's no emotion.
Good.
It's
or it's there is, like, the characters when they're not, there's plenty of very flat characters, but, like, the characters when they're expressing emotion, it's very cut and dry and clear, and this is what is being felt right now, as opposed to, like,
and he was sad.
It's telling and not showing.
Yeah. And so as his later stories developed, he did some of his robot series, including the earliest ones, did feature the character Susan Calvin, who was a forceful and intelligent woman who regularly outperformed her male colleagues. And so for me, I think that maybe, like, that's probably, like, the only woman I actually remember from any works that I've read of him.
She's the one that invents robots, isn't she?
Yes. Yes. And the one thing that I do think that is really interesting about Asimov, which is, as much as he does have his critiques, he always answered them in later work. So, like, he would specifically do something to prove that he could do it after somebody would critique his work. So the larger part also that puts into his portrayal with women is the fact that while Asimov believed himself a feminist, although he believed himself a feminist not necessarily because he believed women should be equal, but because he believed that feminine equality would mean population control. That was his reason. Yeah.
Wait, I'm taking this back a second to the characters where they just express how they feel out loud instead of showing us. I can't find the exact quote, but basically, in one of the robot novels, when the, like, main robot character and the main human character meet each other again, there's a clear, like, development of these characters where they, you know, the human is suddenly a lot more, like, fond of robots than ever before, and, you know, humans absolutely detest robots on Earth during this time period, and the robot, he arrives and he's like, if I could feel, I would say that I missed you too. And it's this, like, really actually, like, beautiful moment, especially because it was written like 40, 50 years after the last Robots book, I'm pretty sure. So it's like really nice moment, but it's like, let me tell you and my with my cold robotic hands how I feel emotionally. And it's definitely,
I actually really enjoy that.
But it's like, it's actually a really great little moment, and it's so it's not like there's no emotional depth to the stories or the characters. It's just the way that he writes it.
Asimov kind of was, like, in fact, a robot who only thought that way.
Exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, it's as if he himself was a robot that understood emotion but couldn't express it in full himself. Which, you know, based on all of his other hypermasculinities, doesn't sound surprising. But
pretty much. So the other thing that is in this whole women point that I felt that I had to include and kind of comment on is, so yeah, while he believed himself a feminist, He was also a very typical man of the 1950s into the 1970s, and essentially a lot of Asimov's behavior led to, as a leading science fiction author and personality, contributed to an undesirable atmosphere for women in the male-dominated space of science fiction. And specifically, it was because he would hit on women all of the time and touch them as well at conventions, conferences, fan signings, which is actually interesting because he met his second wife at a fan signing. And so essentially, one of the things that I would like to point out as a woman who loves science fiction is, as much as it is his fault for being a terrible, terrible creep, the community let it happen continually. So the fact that the science fiction community at that time facilitated this type of stuff, not just from Asimov, but there are other writers that did the same type of behavior, all of that led to having a either women only writing under pen names or a lot of women not writing outright, which is why we have the golden age of science fiction is completely male-dominated with male stories, and all of that is because of the type of atmosphere that was created. And because of Asimov's prolific nature in it, he was one of the main people who contributed to it. But yeah, so it sucked to, and this is despite a woman literally inventing science fiction. But yeah, that happened.
Welcome to the 50s.
Welcome to the 50s and or any situation that wasn't, hey, go be a housewife, in any community, which sucks. And which is one of the beautiful things about Star Trek, because although there were issues in Star Trek, Roddenberry made it very, very clear that that wasn't welcome in his community. So when the first fan con started with Star Trek, they were very welcoming. Just saying.
Yeah, even though, I mean, like you said, he took criticism and later would try and incorporate better attempts at things into his later books. Yes, in his later books, he included more women, I already forget her name, but the one that literally invented robots. Susan, yeah. But so, he had one character in the second robot book, Ladaya, who was, a hapless, helpless woman that accidentally got caught up in a mystery murder scheme, and just like all of the women he had written to that point was basically, didn't really have their own personhood, didn't have their own autonomy over anything, and was just hypersexualized and all of these just blah blah blah. And so in the later robot books, when he returns to the series, he includes her again, and he does improve on, she actually is her own character and has her own desires. And she has some of that a little bit originally, but definitely improves on it coming back around to it. But he still ends up writing her as a super hypersexualized, promiscuous person who, gets the main character, Elijah, to sleep with her numerous times in a kind of, not great scenes, and writes her as, even though, and we'll talk about this I'm sure in a bit about how he's obsessed with social sciences as well as the hard sciences, where he spends all this time just writing about her in all these sexual ways and passes it off as, oh well, it's because we're talking about the science of these worlds and how their relationships work and blah blah blah. But in reality, you read it now and you're and in the context of knowing what kind of person he was, you read it and you're you did not understand how to write women or understand women, period. And it's a little gross.
And it's one of those things too, to contextualize it for everybody listening. He didn't, when he came back to a series, he wasn't coming back to a series 2 years later. I believe the first robot book came out in the 50s and the last robot book came out in the 80s. And there are only three of them, I believe, three or four.
Three and a half.
And so one of the things that you can look at specifically from Asimov's progression in his series is they start in one decade and actually start in one generation and end in another generation. And you can kind of see those generational shifts and changes in the writing. And then you also have those moment of like overcorrecting, because another one of the critiques of his writing was specifically his the fact that there was no sex or sexuality and there were no aliens. And so this wasn't always together, but the fact that neither one of those things came up. And so this critique specifically came from new wave science fiction authors who were usually British. And so essentially he wrote The Gods Themselves, which is a book from the 70s. It was written to push back on those specific two things. Asimov and so the second part of three of the novel is set on an alien world with three sexes, and the sexual behavior of these creatures are extensively depicted. And beyond that, Asimov explained that he had a reluctance to write about aliens because of an early incident with one of his editors who rejected his stories because he would make aliens a superior to humans. So he kind of internalized that bias, or he internalized that and assumed that any editor that he would come by was going to have this anthropomorphic bias, or like this human bias, that humans would have to be presented as better. And so he didn't write about aliens at all.
So interesting, like the robot books, the original one, Caves of Steel especially, like there's no aliens in any of his Foundation novels basically, and I think that being a low fiction, like this takes place in the same world as us, is actually part of why some of his concepts are so long lasting.
Yeah,
but the original Caves of Steel robots book is literally like there's the Earthlings and there's the Spacers, the humans that left Earth several generations ago, went off to become their own separate people on 49 other planets, and now they're pretty much the equivalent of aliens with how they have 300 plus year lifespans, and their technology and their science and everything are so much further advanced than Earthlings. And that's so interesting what you're saying, how he was rejected from the publisher and like refused to write about aliens, but then literally like the same internalization, the same concept of the Spacers are superior to the Earthlings, and
yeah,
just interesting. Everyone's better than humans.
Yeah, well, because he didn't want to, like, the way he saw it specifically and how it was described is he didn't want to write weak aliens, because in his mind it was just like, if there's an alien, they're gonna be better than a human, especially if the two are meeting. Which is super interesting. And then when you move to
I'm gonna say, as much as it's super interesting, I mean, that's basically how not all, but most people think anyways, because at the end of the day, like, we've been to, what, the moon? And so, at this point, if any alien race makes it to us, they already have space travel completed, so they, therefore, their technology will already be vastly better than us in general. So, like, as much as it is, like, I couldn't see writing weak aliens in general, because unless we go to another planet somehow and we meet them aliens, there's no way aliens theoretically could ever be weaker than us, because they will already have the technology that's better than us.
Yeah.
by a long way. So like, I guess for me, like from a science perspective, like every astrophysicist we ever talk about or ever see, if you ever watch any alien stuff or just planets thing, just by those common rules and principles, aliens cannot be weaker than humans, because we can't make it to the moon.
It's why Stephen Hawking said, stop sending signals into space, you're going to kill us all.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically, that's why, because anybody that makes it here and we can't make it to them, well, just by principle, is better than us.
Yeah.
It's the reason why Thanos attacked Earth, because we said, hey, look, we're good enough to space now, so. But well, I mean, in the grand arc of his writing, he also clearly has a pretty dismal view of humanity. I mean, literally anytime there's Earthlings, they're either these backwater people that destroyed their own planet, or they're so far inferior technologically and sociologically to the Spacers that they're like a separate species. And all of his series are about the like collapse of of systems of government and the end of empires, so clearly he doesn't think so fondly of humanity.
Which, once again, has anything that's happened since that time been any way different than what you just explained?
Nope, I, in fact, do
and
not
like,
have...
Which is another thing, because we've done the whole, they did the science theory of, like, basically, there is a theory and a formula that they use to see, like, how long a civilization would last and whether they get full space travel. And every time they've done humans, we've never made it to the point to where we could say we could actually make space travel, because we will end up killing ourselves. And so therefore, I mean, this is actual, like, science theorems and formulas they do and run all the time. So, like, he's not wrong in a lot of sense when you look at the principles of science and physics and basically how they're looking at space travel in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's why his science was real science fiction.
Yeah. But people are awful? Yeah, I can walk outside and tell you that.
So, to round out this point with the critiques, the gods themselves, which features both aliens and sex, and alien sex, won the Nebula Award for Best Novel in 1972, and the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1973. And Asimov said that of all his writings, he was most proud of the middle section of the gods themselves, which was where the aliens and alien sex all came to be, which I just put in there because, one, it shows that he, like, took people's critique and was like, F you, I can do it. And two, this man has two of the most prestigious science fiction awards because he was spiteful. Like,
I love it. He's not only, I can do it, but I'll do it better than all of you.
And then you can read the aliens do it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to be make the most, you know, upper sexual.
And aliens
book,
are better than us, so, you know.
Yeah, if you're going to make the most hypersexual alien just doing it all the time, you might as well do it to troll everybody.
The gods themselves is definitely one of the books that I want to read by him. Not yet. Only imagine
that audiobook. Like.
I'm not sure that one has one. maybe that's part of why.
So the next part is just the lasting legacy of his work. So depending on the counting convention that you're using, so depending on what books you're counting, which ones you're not counting, if you're just counting his popular science, you're just counting his science fiction, that kind of stuff. So depending on if you're including the titles, the charts, collections, there may be over 500 books in Asimov's bibliography. There is at least 500 books in Asimov's bibliography, as well as individual short stories, individual essays, and criticisms. So for his 100th, 200th, and 300th books based on his personal count, Asimov published Opus 100, Opus 200, and Opus 300, celebrating his own writing. And then an extensive bibliography of Isaac Asimov's work has also been compiled by Ed Seiler, which puts him at well over 500 books. An online exhibit at the West Virginia University Libraries virtually complete Asimov collection displays features, visuals, and descriptions of some of his over 600 books, games, audio recordings, videos, and wall charts. Like,
love a good wall chart.
Wall charts are amazing.
Many first, rare, and autographic editions are in the library's rare book room. Book jackets and autographs are presented online with descriptions and images of children's books, science fiction art, multimedia, and other materials in the collection. So, at least 500 when you don't count everything. At least 600 when you count everything. And also the scope that he has both science fiction novels and wall charts should just, show you the scope of what this guy was doing.
I'm more fascinated that the West Virginia University of all universities is the one that has this.
That is interesting. I didn't look up why, though.
It does feel kind of random.
The Mountaineers.
You know, the next time someone tells you don't start a podcast because it'll ruin your academic career, just show them Asimov's CV.
Yeah. So his main series is the Robot series, which is the Caves of Steel, the Naked Sun, the Robots of Dawn, Robots and Empire. You then have Galactic Empire novels, Pebble in the Sky, The Stars Like Dust, The Currents of Space. Then you have the original Foundation trilogy, which is Foundation, Foundation Empire, Second Foundation. Then you have the Foundation prequels, which is Prelude to Foundation and Forward the Foundation. Then you have the extended Foundation series, which is Foundation's Edge and Foundation and Earth. Then you have the Lucky Star series, which is David Star, Space Ranger, Lucky Star and the Pirates of the Asteroid, Lucky Star and the Ocean of Venus, Lucky Star and the Big Sun of Mercury, Lucky Star and the Moons of Jupiter, and Lucky Star and the Rings of Standard. Remember, that is a YA series. And then you have the Norby Chronicles, which he wrote with Janet Asimov. Which there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's 10 of those books, so I'm not going to name them all. But with having such a vast collection of works, he doesn't have that many adapted films or anything, really. So his the entirety of the adapted works in film is Bicentennial Man,
Terrible.
End of Eternity, iRobot, Nightfall 2000, Nightfall 1980, and 1988, and then Robots 1988. And that's it.
And none of that's those are even like his novels. They're all based off of
short stories.
Or in the case of iRobot, it's not even based on an actual story. It's kind of just an amalgamation of his concepts into an original story.
Yep.
I feel like I've seen one of the Nightfalls, but I cannot remember, to be honest.
And in addition to this legacy, to show you just how long it is, according to UNESCO's Index Translationum database, Asimov is the world's 24th most translated author. And from this, and when we look into the lasting pieces of his legacy outside of just having had such a big impact and just the sheer number of his works and the number of awards that he won are two things. The first is Psychohistory. So Psychohistory is the name of a fictional science in Isaac Asimov's Foundation universe, which combined history, psychology, and mathematical statistics to create a nearly exact science of the behavior of very large populations of people, such as the Galactic Empire. Asimov used the analogy of a gas. In a gas, the motion of a single molecule is very difficult to predict, but the mass action of the gas can be predicted at a high level of accuracy. Asimov applied this concept to the population of the fictional Galactic Empire, which numbered in the quadrillions. Later on in his career, Asimov described historical origins of psychohistory in The Robots of Dawn, which takes place thousands of years before Foundation, and he describes roboticists Han Festolf's attempts to create a science based on careful observation of others, particularly his daughter. And in Prelude to Foundation, we learn that this was, in fact, one of Festolf's robots. This word and concept was coined by Asimov, but it didn't have the staying power that robotics does. And Jason, I know you have some stuff to say about psychohistory here.
Just that, like, in addition to being someone who is all into the hard sciences, and, you know, as we'll talk about with the robot stuff, like, he was equally interested in social science and his books are equal part social science fiction as they are natural sciences fiction, where his robots books and the Empire books and probably everything he writes maybe is just seeped with questions about humanity itself and the whole psychohistory when it comes to just like what will people do given this situation or these sets of weird ways that societies are constructed. Like in some of the robot books, there's planets where the people are abhorrent of human contact and they have to live miles apart from one another on their own separate estates because they're like they've just developed as a society into being afraid of human contact, and just gets into all of these crazy in-depth scientific speculations on the ways that people think and act, pretty much to the same extent that he does with the natural sciences. You don't always see a whole lot of that in science fiction writing, at least to the same extent where it's like he will literally make up theorems and scientific concepts to try and back up or use real science to back up his social science theories.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody that's ever taken a genetics course, they tell you to do that with populations all the time. You know, they say, hey, we'll take 5 characteristical traits, and then we'll run a simulation all the time, and you see what happens. And for some people, it becomes a fun game. And obviously, it's one thing doing it with fish, you know, seeing if they turn into blue, teal, pink, or green, and what grows horns and what does not. But, you know, doing it with humans is also a fun concept to see what actually happens. I mean, was it the sound of thunder, I believe, or lightning? That whole concept of, like, you break one thing.
Yeah, it's a sound of thunder, which then informs the butterfly effect.
Yeah, pretty much. Gotcha. Which, I mean, that whole thing is fun to, I mean, the movie's still weird, but, you know, the whole...
Ray Bradbury, it was a short story by Ray Bradbury.
I mean, I know it's a short story. I've read the short story, but I'm about to make a movie out of it. And the movie's actually not as bad a thing. But no, the whole point of the thing is, like, kind of just seeing what you could do just messing up certain variables is a fun thing to do. I mean, I don't know. It's fun. I mean, I used to play with these little programs. Like I said, you can find genetic programs and plug in whatever characteristics you want and see, and even civilization programs and see what happens all the time. And it's fun to do and see what happens. Sometimes they die out real fast. Sometimes they go big. Sometimes they do whatever. So I can see playing with that.
So question. So Minority Report was based on Philip K. Dick's novel, and I think that came out in the 50s. Did psychohistory predate the Minority Report concept, or did Minority Report predate that? Because they seem kind of
Foundation,
similar.
Foundation, I think, is older than Minority Report. I would
assume so. Okay.
It was first a thing in Foundation, which I think he wrote the original short stories.
Yeah, yeah, that predates it, yeah, because the novella from Dick was, I think, 55? Mid-50s? I don't know the exact date. That makes sense.
Just on social science fiction, too, one thing that I've just been thinking about a whole lot recently, just as a random example, so, like, his first published full novel was Pebble in the Sky, I believe, which is basically a story about an older man who slips through time to 10,000 years in the future on an Earth that is now part of the Galactic Empire, and they're like this irradiated planet, and some folks representing the Empire come to the Earth and are trying to basically prove. So there's this archaeologist who's trying to prove that Earth was the original planet that humanity came from across the whole empire, and the empire is like, no, that's not possible. Humanity, the prevailing theory is polygenesis, that humanity is the ultimate form of life, and it started on different planets at the same time, and just coincidentally, and they all eventually proliferated across the galaxy, and now here we are today. And the whole book is about this fight over polygenesis, which frankly, like, so polygenesis in, like, well, when we talk about that in our own planet is usually when we're talking about a theory of the evolution of humanity, and that black humans and white humans derived from different descendants of Noah in the Bible, and that's why there's different races, and that's the super racist theory of polygenesis as it exists in, like, real time. And so, like, Asimov writing this book using the same concept of polygenesis but on a galactic scale, and, like, being like, you are all, like, polygenesis in the 40s was probably still something that people believed in, and him writing this story about how your idea of polygenesis is racist and absurd is, like, pretty interesting way to write social science fiction. I really appreciated reading that book, like, today, and seeing how these concepts of social science played out throughout his writings, because, you know, it's not just like he's using it as the background. He'll take some really in-depth scientific thought on these theories and on all of the sides of each character's beliefs about human origin, and, you know, ultimately the apologenesis is lost because it's an absurd, racist, gross theory. But
And then that moves into the last but why though here, which is the three laws of robotics. Because Asimov himself believed that he had two contributions that were his enduring contributions to the world, and that was the Foundation series and the three laws of robotics. So Karl Čapek, who was a Czech writer, gave us the word robot when he used the word in a play in 1921. Robot was derived from a Slavic term for a slave. The word described man-like machines that worked on a factory assembly line. And then in 1941, in his own short story titled Liar, Asimov became the first person to use the word robotics, referring to the technology that robots possess. The next year, he wrote another short story called Runaround, in which he introduced the three laws of robotics. These laws explain that a robot cannot hurt a human, must obey humans, and we'll get more into them. At the time, he believed it was simply the natural analog of words, such as mechanics or hydraulics, but for robots. Unlike his word psychohistory, the word robotics continues in mainstream technical use with Asimov's original definition. Additionally, Star Trek The Next Generation featured androids with positronic brains, and the first season episode, Data Lore, called the positronic brain Asimov's dream. The three laws of robotics form an organizing principle and unifying theme in Asimov's robotic-based fiction, appearing in his Robot series, the stories linked to it, and his Lucky Star series for young adult fiction. The laws are incorporated into almost all of the positronic robots appearing in his fiction and cannot be bypassed, being intended as a safety feature. Which I think, isn't that the same thing with androids in Star Trek, Adrian?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say like for sure, because then people are going to come and be like, you're wrong. But yeah.
So other authors working in Asimov's fictional universe have also adopted them as references. Often, parodic appear through science fiction and other genres as well. So essentially the three laws that I'm about to say are something that, even though Isaac Asimov made for his own work, are replicated in pretty much every other piece of work that employs robots or androids in this way. So the first law, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law, a robot must obey the orders given to it by human beings except where such others would cause conflict with the first law. Third law, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. The original laws have been altered and elaborated on by Asimov and other authors. Asimov himself made slight modifications to the first three in various books and short stories to further develop how robots would interact with humans and each other. In later fiction, where robots had taken responsibility for the government of whole planets and human civilizations, Asimov also added a fourth law, known as the Zareth Law, to precede the others, and it states, a robot may not harm humanity or by inaction allow humanity to come to harm. The three laws and the Zareth have pervaded science fiction and are referred to in many books, films, and other media. They've impacted, but the coolest thing is that they've impacted ethics on artificial intelligence in the real world as well. Robotic ethics is an entire field of study, the same way astrobiological ethics is, which I actually wish I had kept doing that. That was cool. But robotic ethics and morality essentially is that robots and artificial intelligences do not inherently contain or obey the three laws. Their human creators have to choose to program them in and devise a means to do so. Robots already exist. The robots that already exist in our world are too simple to understand when they are causing pain or injury and to know when to stop. Many are constructed with physical safeguards such as bumpers, warning beepers, safety cages, or restricted access zones to prevent accidents. Even the most complex robots that are currently produced are incapable of understanding and applying the three laws. Significant advances in AI would be needed in order for it to do so. And essentially, if AI could reach the human level intelligence, the inherent ethical complexity as well as cultural and contextual dependency of the laws prevent them from being a good candidate to formulate the robotics design with Asimov's constraints. That being said, in March 2007, the South Korean government announced that later in the year it would issue a robot ethics charter, setting standards for both users and manufacturers. According to Park Hae-young, the Ministry of Information and Communication, the charter may reflect Asimov's three laws, attempting to set ground rules for future developments in robotics. Then, in July-August of 2009, issue of the IEEE Intelligence Systems, Robin Murphy, who is a Raytheon professor of computer science and engineering at Texas A&M, and David D. Woods, who's the director of the Cognitive Systems Engineering Laboratory at Ohio State, proposed the three laws of responsible robotics as a way to simulate discussion about the role of responsibility and authority when designing not only a single robotic platform, but a larger system in which the platform operates. So think algorithms and stuff like that, which goes... So those three laws that they came up with are: a human may not deploy a robot without the human robot work system meeting the highest legal and professional standards of safety ethics. A robot must respond to humans as appropriate for their roles. A robot must be endowed with sufficient situated autonomy to protect its own existence, as long as such protection provides smooth transfer of control, which does not conflict with the first or second laws. So that's an actual thing.
Why do those sound like the worst versions of what we just talked about?
Yeah, like, why did they just use the other thing? Like, who determines what is the highest... There's just too much ambiguity in those laws.
Well, those sound like they devalue the robots more than anything.
Exactly.
To be honest.
Well, they're built on the idea that, like, the humans have to put something into them. So it puts more onus on what a human does to build a robotic system than the actual robots themselves.
Because we just spent the past hour saying humans are terrible. So why would we want to devalue robots for more humans?
Because this actually has to do with something now. Because none of our existing robotics actually can reach the capacity of thinking for themselves and understanding laws. So the important thing is making sure humans can create algorithms and robotic systems that can then enforce the laws.
We're all going to die.
I mean,
sounds like Korea algorithms... just really wanted to be special and make their own.
Well, this wasn't Korea. this was Americans.
This is American.
Even worse.
That's why I said, like, reading this way they deployed the language and everything, it sounds like they devalued the robot standard in general and basically...
I don't think they devalued it. They said, humans, you need to make sure that you do this when you make robots. The robots aren't thinking for themselves. It's the humans who make them that are putting all those systems in place. It's why algorithms are still racist and some technology doesn't work on dark skin, because the people who are making them aren't thinking about the other thing. So the importance is putting it on humans to actually think about those robotic systems that they're creating, which I don't think is a bad thing.
So,
I mean, the whole thing is just broken in the beginning, because it's like, a human may not deploy. Okay, a human will do it whether he wants to or not. Like, he's not thinking about checks and balances on algorithms. He's just like, he's either going to do it or he's not going to do it. So just like right away, like, oh, the law says I may not deploy the robot without thinking about these things. But the human's just going to be like, oh, not deploy that shit. Like, send that robot there.
Well, that's why they're talking about it, because they actually want to have robotic ethics to keep that stuff in line. The same way biomedical ethics keep that pieces in line, because just putting coke in things like they used to do doesn't work, which is why biomedical ethics is an entire field to keep stuff from happening.
It's like, I mean, the ones that the dumb Americans came up with is more realistic, because, like, I mean, there's no such thing as a positronic brain. We don't have an ability to just say, we've done it. We've programmed robots to never break these three laws, and it's perfect now. And it's like, until such a time comes, I guess we're stuck with saying, well, the Russian came up with these ones, so we're making our own American version.
There is another version.
Most of his life in America.
So there is another version. In 2013, Alan Winfield suggested at a EUCOG meeting a revised 5 laws that had been published with commentary. Specifically, robots. So, 1, robots are multi-use tools. Robots should not be designed solely or primarily to kill or harm humans, except in the interests of national security, which so I clearly like undercuts.
Clearly, the American did not have this thing. One.
So this is another American.
That is nope. I don't even need to hear the rest. These are useless.
Humans, this is Space Force. This is like Space Force stuff right now. This is what this is.
Humans, not robots, are responsible agents. Robots should be designed and operated as far as practical to comply with the existing laws, fundamental rights, and freedoms, including privacy. Robots are products. They should be designed using processes that assure their safety and security. Robots are manufactured artifacts. They should not be designed in a deceptive way to exploit vulnerable users. Instead, their machine nature should be transparent. And finally, the person with legal responsibility for a robot should be attributed.
So, are these the laws, then, that were used for Detroit Become Human video game that came out?
It sounds like it. It sounds like it, and I don't like it.
Because all I know is
we got 2013, and what, that game came out, what, 2018, 2019?
Yeah.
You know, a few years of concept, and then a few years of development. We could probably get along that.
As soon as you give a national security exception to anything, you
have
handed over the monopoly of violence, and you have created an absolutely useless rule.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. That's all I had for that. So on to the fun facts. Matt already brought it up Matt brought up this Humanist Association. I brought up the fact that he was a president of the American Humanist Association, which also leads into the fun fact that Isaac Asimov is one of the most well-known atheists in America, which is really cool. He was culturally Jewish, but atheist as a non-religion. The asteroid 5020 is named as Asimov. So the asteroid 5020, a crater on the planet Mars, a Brooklyn elementary school, Honda's humanoid robot, Asimo, and 4 literary awards are all named after Isaac Asimov.
What about the South Park episode with Asimo?
Asimo. Asimov was so prolific that his books span every single major category of the Dewey Decimal System classification, except for category 100, which is philosophy and psychology, despite him actually having... So if you go into any category of the Dewey Decimal System, you will find an Asimov book, except for in psychology, instead of category 100, but he did actually write a couple of psychological papers. They just aren't featured in there. And then my favorite one, because musical, Isaac Asimov actually wrote a movie musical for Paul McCartney. It was a robot musical.
I did not have, we're going to talk about a musical on my bingo for this episode. Let alone Paul McCartney music.
And that's it. That's all I have for Isaac Asimov.
That's all?
That's all.
Paul McCartney singing about robots.
So, final thoughts, everybody. Adrian.
Yeah, for me, so I didn't really talk about this episode, but just mainly because I'm absorbing a lot and I just knew we're already way over time already, so I didn't think I really had a whole lot other than just kind of like digest what this is and kind of what stories that I would be interested in listening to in the future. And there seems like some really cool ones here, like super lasting effects, right? Like we have nothing, you know, staying power wise of robotics. Obviously not the first, but like we've talked about many times over the course of this year, like just because you're not the first one to do it doesn't mean you can't be the best one to do it. And he definitely brings a lot to the robotics part of this, and I guess alien humping, which is interesting, because I too would like more alien humping in my Star Wars. That'd be okay with that.
So to be fair, there's a lot of that in 50s science fiction. They were mad at him because he didn't have it.
Well, he should have added it in. It would have been fantastic. It would have been great. it seems great. Like, if I'm just being completely honest, I just really like iRobot. I wore that DVD out. I love iRobot. I love the concept of iRobot. But if these last little parts you talked about of us like actually doing these laws has anything to do with it, then like we're screwed. Like, the dude is like the father of like robotics for a reason. Just go with his laws, and then we'll worry about everything else after, because we're gonna die.
If we can't have his laws, we don't deserve any. No robots.
Yeah, exactly.
No robots until we've got his laws.
Yeah. And this is crazy. Like, this dude is going to be, like, in the conversation. This science fiction writer guy is going to be, like, basically the governing, you know, what everyone's going to start with in this conversation. And he just wrote, like, a bunch of books and was really, really smart. Like, that's insane.
Yeah, which I guess kind of goes into my final thoughts of, one, I don't really read a lot of books, per se. And so, but it's always been something of, like, his work, just because I'm like, I knew of him before for all the other ends that we talked about, the science parts and the robot parts and the, you know, the humanist association parts, and not so much of his work was. It actually took me like probably a little while of actually like looking into it. Oh, he wrote a lot of stuff apparently that wasn't the science fiction. Oh, that's a thing. But no, obviously the man did a lot of stuff that clearly intrigues me, and based on the foundations of like just whether science and just looking at some of the cool, interesting aspects of what you can do when you, you know, apply random things, I guess, or random concepts to principles and see what you get, whether it is splitting an atom and ending up in weird times and whatnot else, or just, you know, how we take, you know, different variables and what happens from there. So it will be interesting to see, you know, kind of like moving forward, especially in the field of robotics, of what happens. And then too, I guess, trying to add any of the layers of, you know, the science fiction part as we move into possibly space, if we don't blow ourselves up first, you know, how this all applies from man writing basically back, like, almost, not quite 100 years, like, what, 80 years ago, 90 almost at this, or 70 at this point. So seeing what, how his books line up, because that has been an interesting thing, I think, as we've gotten further and further, of people going back and looking at these science fiction writers, and probably including himself, Asimov, you know, what they wrote about and everything, and how they're laying on as we get farther and farther. And while they're not always 100% correct, it's been interesting to see how many of them seem to be a lot of, they kind of line up in some ways. And so seeing how we get farther and farther, what his works end up lining up, per se, as we get into the future.
Yeah, that's kind of where my final thought is, because we end up seeing this cycle of, it happens in science fiction, it happens in real life, and it's one of those things where it's kind of like a chicken egg question, like which one inspired what. So sliding doors, or like automatic doors, was a Star Trek thing first, and it wasn't like thought of really most outside there, and then it ended up becoming a thing. Same thing with like the biometric scanners and like those kind of stuff. And so like when we look at Asimov's stuff, it's going to be interesting to see, like, I don't know if there's a way to detach what people inspire and then what gets made actually scientifically. And so I think that it's going to be really cool, because we're getting to the place in robotics where it feels like we're getting closer and closer, not necessarily to replicating human intelligence, but we're getting closer to replicating action. So, like, if you want to get creeped out, watch the Boston Dynamics videos of, like, the dog robots that they make that move very much like dogs, or the dancing robots, which are terrifying, but actually mimic the very small movements that a human body makes. And so, for me, it's really interesting that, like, the first thing that we're adapting now in this current stage of robotics is, how do we replicate the very small nuances in human and biological movement? And so, I wonder how long it is going to take for us to start moving toward that positronic brain.
I believe they're doing that with dolphins to replace actual marine animals as well.
Oh, wow.
So that way you don't have, the flipper can actually live in the ocean and not have to be in the pool.
Yeah.
But no, obviously, by the way, I think it's more of one of those, I think if we switch, I think it's just priorities. I feel, as much as we feel we're so far off, I feel like if we just said, hey, instead of funding all the churches, we cut all that off, tax them, and then we fund all this stuff in robotics, I feel like we could be there in like 5-10 years at this point. Like, it's just, we devalue science in general. Not saying that we don't get big stuff here, but like, when you look at budgets of education and like, especially science and everything, they get very, very slivers. So if any of this money eventually transitions and go forward, I think we'd be surprised on how fast we can actually move forward. I guess also just thinking of like what we did with NASA, especially in thinking of how fast we progress so much stuff, because when you actually focus on it and you actually invested it and you actually prioritize it, I think we could. I think it could be a lot closer than what we think. Think about it. It's just one of those of like, hey, you get a screwdriver and 3 nails. Go make me a human robot. Versus we give them unlimited budgets and see if they can make
it. Yeah, we could be banging robots in no time if we just wanted it bad enough.
I mean, Adrian's, there's other countries that seem to be farther ahead of that already.
Just don't want it badly enough.
Jason, final thoughts.
Yeah. Asimov's got some smart stuff in his noggin. I like the books I've read, most of them so far. I recommend it. I honestly recommend what I did and start with robot books not Foundation, because I think that the stuff that we've been talking about with the robots is just it's the most interesting and the most thoroughly conceived. And the most, affecting everything that we know about science fiction, basically, since then. And, yeah.
Well, Jason, thank you for coming on this episode. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, or interact with you, however you want to do it.
Yeah. I'm on Twitter, at @flatter_you. FLATTER_YOU. You can find my editing and writing at But Why Though and at foodtank.com. And yeah, that's me.
Exciting.
And you can find the podcast at But Why Though PC on every single social media platform in existence. Except for that stupid one that Ted Cruz created. And you can find me... Oh, and if you want to support us a little bit more, head on over to patreon.com/butwhythoughpc. You can find me on Twitter at @OhMyMythRandier. Adrian?
Yep, you can find me on Twitter at SuperReese93, SuperReuiz93.
Matt?
I'm going to go back to making Anno, which is essentially just the game version of making a civilization to see what ends up happening and how long you last before you kill everybody else.